Wow. Praise God. I'm so glad to be here in Tyler, Texas. I want to thank everyone, the Church of God International, for this invitation. I want to thank Charles and Jeff and everybody. I'm just really excited to be here for a lot of reasons. And, you know, I look at the app that you guys have, and I'm going to tell you what, it's state of the art, okay? I want to tell you that. I really want to encourage you guys to promote that app. And I just really see just explosive growth coming for you guys. I'm very excited. And so I just want to encourage you guys today to keep fighting the good fight of the faith, because you guys are reaching a lot of people around the world. And it is so very encouraging just to be in an atmosphere that is mission-minded and kingdom-minded. And I'm just very glad to be here today. And at today's message, we are going to talk about History of the Sabbath Part 2. Last time I was here last year, we began an examination of church history as it relates to the Sabbath. And we're going to continue that today. We're going to review some of the details we reviewed last year, but we're going to mostly cover some new material. And in particular, we're going to cover one era of history where there's a lot of confusion. But I want to start with the question, why should we study Sabbath history? Why should we study Sabbath history? And I think it's very important for us to study history because we will have a greater appreciation for what we have today when we understand the sacrifices and the character of those who've come before us. It is so important. And number two, when we understand our own history, we will better understand our future. When we better understand our history, we will better understand our future. And I always use this as a good example. Imagine that you were about to make a very serious decision in your life, but someone in the past had already made that decision or a similar decision, and maybe it didn't go too well for them. And you can kind of see in this scenario where history will help us to avoid mistakes of the past, but it will also help us to repeat the successes of the past, the triumphs of the past. And so I don't know if they're going to have the PowerPoint up. Oh, okay. Do I need to hold on or I just need to keep going? All right, sure, no problem. No problem.
Kelly, just as a matter of while they're doing that, why don't you let everybody know what you do and you're the president of the
association? Absolutely. Absolutely. So my name is Kelly McDonald. Again, I'm president of the Bible Sabbath Association, or the BSA for short. The BSA is an organization that was founded in 1945 to promote fellowship between Sabbath keepers and to provide resources for Sabbath keepers. You know, we believe at the BSA that we can accomplish a lot more if we can work together. And if we, you know, if we share our resources, we all have more, especially in terms of the literature that we all the groups have available, and in terms of human talent, in terms of speakers and musicians and things of that nature. And so as president of the BSA, I travel throughout the United States. I've even gone to some other countries to talk about Sabbath history, but to talk about subjects that encourage Sabbath keepers in our mutual faith, because, you know, we have a lot in common between churches. I know that you know, sometimes we have a tendency maybe to, in our minds, maybe to focus on things that we don't have in common. But if we'll stay on what we have in common, we'll see each other as children of God. And I think that is so very important. This past year at the CFN feast, I gave a sermon about the old wineskin versus the new wineskin. And the old wineskin is a past way of thinking that maybe looks at people in terms of what group they belong to. But the new wineskin, and which I believe is here at CGI, is looking at every person who has the Holy Spirit as a child of God, a unique, a begotten again child of God who has incredible potential because of the awesome God that we serve. And so I'm really excited to be able to go to different churches and really encourage people and educate them. I'm an ordained evangelist as well with Hungry Hearts Ministries in Jackson, Tennessee. And as an evangelist, I'm an exhorter. So I exhort people. And when you look in the Bible and you read the Greek word that's translated exhort, it means to call people from where they are to where God wants them to be. It's a very powerful word. And so I really enjoy, as being an evangelist, educating the body of Christ. And today, in today's presentation, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to really spend a lot of time talking about Constantine, because there's a lot of things about the Constantinian era that I think there's misconceptions about that we want to clarify. So we're good. All right. So why study Sabbath history? As I said, we're going to better appreciate what we have. We will better understand our future. So to highlight our need to understand our own history, I have a meme that was shared a lot on Facebook, and that's the next slide. It's titled Sunday Services. Sunday Services. And I'll read this for you because that's kind of small print. This is a meme that was shared on Facebook by a lot of Sabbath keepers. Here's what it says. Early believers kept Saturday as the Sabbath until March 7th, 321 CE, when Pope Constantine passed a law requiring believers to worship on Sunday, the day the pagans worshiped the sun god. Believers still kept Saturday as the Sabbath until another law was passed 11 years later. This law, signed a decree by Pope Constantine, forbid believers to worship on the Sabbath or Saturday, and it was punishable by death by the Catholic Church. Many believers were burned to death by the Catholic Church for keeping the Sabbath. Okay, so we've got the meme up here, and I saw many people share this. And I'm not saying anyone in this room shared this, so I'm not picking on anyone, okay? That's not my style, okay? That's not me. But did you know there are 8 historical inaccuracies with this statement, with this meme? There's about 8 of them. And I saw, you know how many times this was shared? Thousands of times it was shared. And when I saw this being shared, I wasn't so much angry as I was grieved. I thought, wow, we don't know our own history. Let me give you some examples of some of the inaccuracies. First of all, Constantine is not the originator of Sunday services, so the whole premise of the title is incorrect. But Constantine wasn't a pope. He was the Roman emperor. So that's another inaccuracy. Constantine never passed a law banning the Sabbath. And that's a shock to some people. Now, to back this up, I have a book of Roman laws here called the Theodosian Code. Okay, I brought it with me to use as a prop. I've read through the pertinent parts of the Theodosian Code. There's not a single law passed in the Roman Empire from 311 A.D. to 439 A.D. that bans the Sabbath. So that's, again, another false belief. It also a false historical statement. The meme also says that early believers kept the Sabbath up until this time period. Well, that's actually not true either. Most Christians kept the Sabbath over 100 years after Constantine's time. The Catholic Church didn't have the authority to put anyone to death in the 300s A.D. They had no temporal authority. And people weren't burned to death for keeping the Sabbath. Those are just most of the historical inaccuracies. So you can see why it's very important we know the truth about these things. You know what I'm saying? I mean, back in the 1800s, there were some people, and I'm not getting into the names and the details. That's not the important thing. The important thing is the subject, the content. There were some people that started this rumor or myth that Constantine changed the Sabbath at the Council of Nicaea in 325, or that he passed a law canceling out the Sabbath. And what we have to understand is that that's simply not true, but we are going to study what Constantine did do. Now, I'm in no way saying that Constantine was a good guy, because he really wasn't, okay? As we're going to find out today. But what I am suggesting is that it's very important for us to make sure that we have our facts straight, and especially on this subject, because so we're going to set the record straight today. You know, we're going to refute some myths about him. Did he actually change the Sabbath? Or, instead, did Constantine have an influence on the Sabbath in an indirect way? What do I mean by indirect? While Constantine did not pass a law banning the Sabbath, he did actually take some actions during his reign that would later have an influence on the Sabbath decades later. So in some ways, he had an indirect influence during his reign. And that's what we're going to get into today. So let's start with the reign of Constantine, and let's start with 313 A.D. Now, in 313 A.D., Constantine was established as the Western Roman Emperor, and his brother-in-law, Licinius, was established over the East. So Licinius married Constantine's his daughter, I'm sorry, not his daughter, his sister. Her name was Constantia. Okay. So some of these names we're going to get into are actually kind of interesting, but so we have to understand that he was a Roman emperor. He was not a pope. He was a Roman emperor. And in 313, he only ruled over the west. Licinius ruled over the east. Now, among the first acts of their joint reign was an edict called the Edict of Milan. This is a very important edict because, you see, the Catholic Church has used the Edict of Milan to propose that Constantine converted to Christianity. And we're going to look at some excerpts from the edict, and we'll decide for ourselves whether or not the content of this edict is representative of someone who had a conversion experience. You know, Jesus said, you'll know them by their fruits. Not you'll know them by their gifts, but you'll know them by their fruits. And so let's see what the Edict of Milan says. We're going to read this excerpt. It says, it ought to be granted, and this, again, this edict was written by Constantine and Licinius jointly. It ought to be granted to the judgment and desire of each individual to perform his religious duties according to his own choice. We had given orders that every man, Christian as well as others, should preserve the faith of his own sect and religion for the benefit of everyone, namely, such as should preserve reverence and piety toward the deity. We resolve, that is, to grant both to the Christians and to all men to follow the religion which they choose, that whatever heavenly divinity exists may be propitious. Now, I want you to notice the language here. That whatever God that there may be. So notice what Constantine is proposing here. He's granting religious toleration, and he's saying, but his reasoning is, he wants people to pray to every God that exists. Now, does that sound like the fruit of a converted believer? Well, no. A Christian's going to only, what? Jesus said, I am the way, not a way, right? So someone who's converted will only encourage prayer to God, the one true God found in the Bible. But let's keep on reading. He says, each one should have the liberty of choosing and worshiping whatever deity he pleases. This has been done by us in order that we might not seem in any way to discriminate against any rank or religion. So that's the Edict of Milan. And so the edict granted religious toleration to all people in the empire. And there's no evidence in this decree that Constantine's really a Christian. I mean, again, you know, it's like kind of like a pantheism, right? He believed in praying to all the gods. It'll just kind of pan out. But there's no evidence from this that he was really a Christian. But I do want to give you a 4th century perspective on his actions. You see, you have to understand that Christians had been persecuted off and on from 64 AD until 313 AD by Roman emperors or their magistrates. So when Constantine granted Christians, hey, I'm going to let you worship God. Well, it was met with enthusiasm by many Christians. They were like, wow, we're finally going to get to worship our God without worrying about being hunted down. However, there were some Christians at this time that elevated him to a very unhealthy status. Let me give you an example. Philostrogus, who's an Arian historian of this time period, writes that there was a statue of Constantine that some Christians offered incense to and prayed to. That's a very unhealthy view of any person, okay? But many Christians welcomed this edict, and there were Christians that thought this was a sign of his conversion. But as we read the edict, you'll find no proof or evidence or fruit that he actually believed in Jesus. Let's look at some of his decrees. We actually have a few of his decrees. I have summaries of these decrees. May 15th, 319 AD, he decreed that soothsayers and priests of the pagan religion of Rome were forbidden to enter private homes. However, he encouraged people to approach the public altars of the gods to celebrate their pagan customs. Now, does this sound like the fruit of conversion? Absolutely not. Now, here is the decree that was referenced in the meme we looked at earlier. I do want to go over this decree. March 7th, 321 A.D. And I actually translated this from Latin myself, from an old copy of the Codex Justinianus. And here's what the first part of this law says. All judges, city dwellers, skill workers, and the offices of all should honor the venerable day of the sun and rest. However, those placed in the country, that means farmers, freely serve the fields of culture. Now, I want to focus on this law for just a moment because, number one, notice there is no reference to Jesus Christ. So he's not setting this day aside because of Jesus. He's not doing it because for any biblical reason whatsoever. There wouldn't be a biblical reason to set aside Sunday, but I'm saying that he has no rationale that he even points to of that nature. Now, in Latin, you'll see venerable day of the sun. Now, in Latin, this is venerables deus solis, the honorable day of the sun. Now, last year when I was here, I showed you a series of coins from the Constantine era that proved beyond the shadow of a doubt he actually was a sun worshiper. And so he set aside Sunday as the day of rest in the Roman Empire to honor the sun. Now, but also notice there's no mention of worship here. Worship is not mentioned in this. It's a civil day of rest, except if you're a farmer, okay? Because you don't get a day off according to this law. But what I want you to notice, because again, the Catholic Church uses this as another proof. They say, see, he was really setting this aside because, you know, he was getting ready to change the Sabbath over to Sunday. But again, we have a lot of evidence lacking to support this view. In fact, so much so, let me show you the law that he received in his court the very next day. March 8, 321 A.D. Constantine received a law allowing the pagan soothsayers to enter buildings where lightning had struck. That's the day after the Sunday law. Now, what does this mean? Okay. You got to understand, in ancient times, whenever there was a disaster like lightning or a fire or a storm, well, the pagans blamed it on some god that was mad. And so they would call in the soothsayers, we'll find out which god's mad and what we got to do to make them happy. And Constantine, the very next day after this Sunday law, says, hey, we want to retain the ancient practice because we want to make the quote-unquote little g gods happy. Again, we're lacking the fruit to point to any kind of conversion here in Constantine's life. Now, there was another Sunday law that we will kind of briefly talk about. There was an inscription found in a Slavonian bathhouse, and I believe it was found in the 1700s or 1800s. And it basically states that Constantine relaxed his Sunday rest law for pagan Roman market days. And I will briefly explain the pagan market days. You see, the ancient Romans didn't have a seven-day week. They had an eight-day week. And the eighth day of the week was called the Nundinae, or a feast day, a market day. And in the first century A.D., the Romans began to adopt the seven-day week in addition to the eight-day week. I know, this some of this stuff. You start reading some of this stuff, I mean, it's legalese, right? But you can imagine if you have a seven-day week and Sunday has to be a rest day, but then you have another reckoning of time that's an eight-day week, eventually the eighth day of the week, which is a feast day or market day, is going to fall on Sunday. And you know what he did? He said, we're going to relax that Sunday rest law for the pagan market day. So again, is Constantine doing this Sunday thing because he finds such a great conviction from the Bible to do so? Well, no, there's nothing in the Bible to support Sunday being the Sabbath, obviously. We know the Sabbath's Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, but the point here, Constantine, he keeps going back to this pagan tendency. Now let's look at the Council of Nicaea, 325. Okay, so I'm going to summarize what happened between 313 and 325 here. Licinius, you remember his brother-in-law, right? Rebelled against him. Talk about your in-laws becoming outlaws. Licinius rebelled against Constantine, but you know, Constantine was a little bit stronger and he overcame him. But one of Constantine's first actions upon becoming emperor over the whole Roman world was to convene a council at Nicaea. People don't realize the Catholic Church didn't call the Council of Nicaea. Constantine called the Council of Nicaea because he was tired of Christians fighting with each other. Now, and let me give you a quote from Constantine. We believe that this is a quote from Constantine, the best we can find historically. A discussion of all peculiars relating to our most holy religion ought to take place, so that no room was left for further discussion or controversy in relation to the faith. So, to summarize what happened at Nicaea, basically, Constantine agrees with the Roman Church. That's like sort of the nutshell of what happens. And, you know, he sides with the Catholic Church in agreeing that the Trinity is truth, even though we know that the Trinity is not in the Bible. But Constantine, at that time, agreed with the Roman Church and said, we're going to, you know, all Christians ought to believe in the Trinity. But I want you to understand, at the Council of Nicaea, there's no mention of the Sabbath. It's not mentioned in any canon. It's not even mentioned, I have not even found it in historical commentaries relating to this. But a group of people called Arians were condemned, and Arians did have Sabbath-keeping tendencies. And Constantine did forbid Christians from keeping Passover in any manner similar to the Jewish people, whether in the reckoning of time or in the eating of unleavened bread, he forbid all that. And he sided with the Roman Church. Because the Roman Church, starting with Anicetus in about 150 A.D., began to keep Passover on a Sunday. And Constantine at Nicaea ruled that's the way it ought to be done. Here's what he said. He said, and first of all, it appeared an unworthy thing that in the celebration of this most holy feast, we should follow the practices of the Jews, who have impiously defiled their hands with enormous sin, and are therefore deservedly afflicted with blindness of soul. Whew, man, that's a pretty rough statement there. This doesn't sound like a person who's come to grasp with their own sin causing the death of the Son of God. But it sounds like somebody who's blaming the Jews for killing Jesus. This is what it sounds like. That's sort of a Roman thought pattern of that time period, unfortunately. And so he goes on to say this: all the brethren in the East who have heretofore kept this festival when the Jews did will henceforth conform to the Romans and to us. So, in the celebration of the Passover, Constantine ruled everybody's got to do it like the Church of Rome. Now, I want you to know, keep this in mind, just because Constantine ruled this did not mean everybody went along with it. You got to understand, they're living in the ancient world. They don't have phones and TVs. When decrees are passed, it might take years for those decrees to spread throughout the Roman world. But this decree is reflective of, number one, the Roman view on the subject, and the emperor's view on the subject, and that there was an attempt to, even with soft power of a decree, try and force other people to do things the way the Roman Church was doing it. But there was something else that happened at Nicaea that would actually have a long-term impact on Sabbatarians beyond what we've reviewed. You see, the group called the Arians that I discussed earlier, they were condemned at the Council of Nicaea. And something happened at Nicaea, and I call it Nicaea is really a dark day in Christian history. And I want to read a quote from Socrates, a Roman historian. He says, Constantine said this: if any treatise composed by Arius should be discovered, let it be consigned to the flames, that means burned up, in order that not only his depraved doctrine may be suppressed, but also that no memorial of him may be by any means left. Well, that's a pretty thorough repudiation of somebody, right? Not only, he just didn't like this guy, he's like, I don't even want him to be remembered. Now, I don't agree with everything Dr. Arius taught, and you guys wouldn't agree with everything Dr. Arius taught. But here's the point. This is a dangerous precedent. Nicaea was the first time a person faced punishment from a civil authority just because they had a different view of the Bible. We're going to take your writings, we're going to burn them up, the Arians were exiled. This is a terrible precedent. Why? Because the precedent at Nicaea said this. Instead of encouraging Christians to get together with their differences with the Bible and work it out with the scriptures, and maybe we still agree to disagree on subjects, instead what Christians would do from Nicaea forward is find a civil authority who would agree with them and get rid of those that disagreed with them. Very dangerous precedent. It would later become one of the justifications for the martyrdom of many Sabbatarians in Asia Minor and in Europe and in other places. Because once again, it wasn't about reasoning the scriptures. It's, let's go find a civil authority who will get rid of the people we don't like. It's a very dangerous precedent. And we're going to see how this precedent impacted things later. So during the reign of Constantine, there was another development. The Roman Empire and the Roman Church became intertwined. And when I say the Roman Church, we would call this the Roman Catholic Church today, but I just call it the Roman Church because at that time the concept of a Roman Catholic Church was sort of foreign. But let me give you some examples of what Constantine did. Constantine started paying the expenses of church councils. So whenever the Catholic Church wanted to have a council, and when they would have these councils, this was usually to resolve doctrinal disputes within the Catholic Church or Roman Church, etc. Constantine started paying those. Hey, we'll cover that for you. Don't worry about it. He also ruled with a law that people were allowed to leave property to the Roman Church. So what do you think happened to the Roman Church? It really grew in its wealth. It grew in its authority because it became a land-owning organization. And I mean massive quantities of land. Here's another one. The Roman Church was granted special privileges, such as exemption from public service. It's kind of like in America, there's jury duty, right? You know? Okay, they had similar stuff in the Roman world. Well, if you belong to the Roman Church, you got a pass on that stuff. We'll let you off on that. Don't worry about it. But other Christian groups weren't given these privileges. He actually regulated the number of clergy in Christianity. Because when he started passing some tax-free laws, everybody wanted to be in the clergy. This is actually what happened. You read the law, he's like, okay, there's great, you know, I could read the law for you, but it says there's great numbers of people becoming Roman Catholic clergy, so therefore we have to limit the number of clergy. Let's go to another one. This one is really important. Secular judges were forced to enforce the decisions of Roman Catholic bishops. Wow. So if a Roman Catholic or a Roman Church bishop says such and such, Roman authorities had to carry that out. If a bishop ever testified against you from the Roman Church, their testimony was considered of greater weight. That's the Roman system, okay? So what's the end result of all this? What's the end result? The Roman Church became an institution of the Roman state. And unfortunately, many Christians did not oppose this. You know, you can imagine most people who are with the Roman Church are like, hey, this is great. You know, I get this benefit and I get that benefit. And so before you know it, a lot of people start moving toward the Roman Church. But the Roman Church at this time was still not the majority belief practice in Christianity. You see, there's a title, Pontifex Maximus. It's an ancient Roman title. And this title gave a person control of religious matters in Rome. You know, this is the title the Pope has today. You know that title, Pontifex Maximus, is 2,700 years old? It's an ancient title. But see, Constantine held the title at this time. And so he exercised this title over the Roman Church. I'll give you, this is just something I thought I'd throw in here for you guys. In 333 to 337 AD, this is toward the end of Constantine's life, Constantine actually had a temple built so people would worship the Flavian line of Roman emperors, which included his own family. And he ordered there to be a temple constructed with priests. Now again, this is toward the end of his life. Does this sound like the fruit of a Christian? Build a temple and worship me? No. I mean, This was found in a recent, this is archaeology. This is crazy. So let's summarize Constantine's reign, because we're going to move into just some a little bit of the time period afterwards, but the time that we have left. Constantine passed a law which made Sunday a day of civil rest in the Roman Empire. It did not force worship. Okay, we have to really understand it, civil day of rest. At Nicaea, he promoted keeping Passover on Sunday instead of the biblical reckoning. He interwove the Roman church with the Roman Empire. He still promoted paganism at times. He never banned the Sabbath, but there were long-term consequences, which we're about to get into. All right. Constantine died in 337. What's interesting, you guys remember Arius, how he hated the Arians and some of the nasty things he said? Well, he was baptized by an Arian at the end of his life. Toward the end of his life, his sister, remember Constantia? She was an Arian, and on her deathbed, she requested he be nice to those people, stop being so mean to them. And Constantine consented to her request, and at the end of his life, you know, he was very much a pro-Arian. Most people don't know that. But if you read the Catholic Encyclopedia, which I have a copy of the 1911 Catholic Encyclopedia, they really get mad. They can't stand that Constantine was baptized by an Arian. They question, well, he was manipulated, you know, by one of the Arian bishops to be. But he actually showed favor to them. So when he died, his empire was left to his three sons. Get this, their names, Constantius, Constan, and Constantine. The guy really liked his name, I guess. Of these three, Constantius would have the greatest influence in the longest reign. But guess what? He was a devoted Arian. Interesting. So as we look at the reign, and I'm not going to go specifically into the reign of Constantius, but I do want to summarize some things. There were no Sunday laws passed during the reign of Constantius. Interesting. But of all the sons, Constantius worked the hardest against paganism. He worked very hard against paganism. I've had two laws of his, very briefly. Number one, he commanded all the pagan temples to be closed. Number two, people who offered sacrifices or bowed to idols were put to death. Those were two of the laws he passed. Now, again, we've got to understand, in ancient times, there was no such thing as instant compliance with these kinds of laws. But there was a degree of enforcement of these laws, and these laws are indicative of what that emperor stood for and represented, what he believed in. So it's kind of interesting, as much as the Catholic Church says Constantine was this great pillar of Christianity, well, it's one of his sons who was an Arian that tried to end paganism in the empire. Wow. But let's go on further in history. 361 to 364, Constantius, that's his son who was Arian, died in 361. There were two short reigns after this, Julian and Jovian. These guys ended up being pro-Roman Catholic, and I use that term interchangeably at this point with Roman Church. And there was a council during this time period called the Council of Laodicea, or Laodicea, as we say in the South. Let's read to you some canons from Laodicea. On Canon 16, it says, on Sabbath or Saturday, the Gospels and other portions of the Scriptures shall be read aloud. So the first thing we notice, now this council is a pro-Roman Church council. The first thing we learn is that even though the Roman Church hates the Sabbath at this point, they still promote some sort of spiritual exercise on the day. But when we read the next canon, we'll see how they really feel about it. Here's Canon 29. Christians shall not Judaize and be idle on Saturday, but shall work on that day. But the Lord's day they shall especially honor. And as being Christians, shall, if possible, do no work on that day. If, however, they are found Judaizing, that means resting on the Sabbath, they shall be shut out from Christ. Now, once again, you keep this in mind. Here's another one. I threw this one here. Canon 37. No one shall accept feastal presents from the Jews and heretics or keep the festivals with them. You've got to understand that in the early church, a lot of the Christians that kept the holy days kept them with Jewish people at that time. In the early church, this was pretty common. That's why this canon was issued. So I want you to understand church councils. Once again, I have to say this. when the Roman church has a council like this in ancient times and they issue these canons or these decrees, it is reflective of their point of view and what they wish to impose upon all Christians. But it does not mean instant compliance, okay? So just because they had a council where they said bad things about the Sabbath doesn't mean everybody stopped keeping the Sabbath. No. But the council is reflective of their belief and their animosity toward the Sabbath. That's what we have to understand. Let me tell you about a guy named Valens real quick as we're moving toward the end here, because we're gonna summarize. We're going to get to the end. We're going to see some pretty interesting developments that happened because of Constantine. Valens was the emperor from 364 to 379 A.D. Now, he was a Roman emperor, and he was an Arian supporter. In between he and Constantius, all of the churches in the Eastern Roman Empire were given to Arians, the people that had Sabbath-keeping tendencies. But here's the key. I have to point this out. You see, Constantine set the precedent of punishing people who belonged to a different point of view than that of the emperor. And see, Valens, you see, Constantine did things against Arians, and toward the end of his life he favored them, but he didn't undo everything that he did. But the pendulum swung back the other way during the reign of Valens, and Valens actually persecuted the Roman church. You see the dangerous precedent at Nicaea, it hurt the Roman church too. So while the Roman church loves Nicaea because it favored them, they hate Valens. But it was the precedent set at Nicaea that Valens used to justify his behavior toward the Roman church. That's why it was a very dangerous precedent. But Valens, he died in 379, and Arians at this time are at the height of their influence. Let me give you a quote from the time period. At this period, all the churches of the East, with the exception of that of Jerusalem, were in the hands of the Arians. Let me give you another quote from the time period. The Arians, who were still very strong in the point of numbers, and who, through the protection formally granted by Constantius and Valens, were still convening without fear and discoursing publicly concerning God and the divine nature. At the same time, a man came to power in the Roman Empire, especially in the East, but some people would say that he had even equal influence in the West. His name was Theodosius. Now, Theodosius was very interesting. At the beginning of his reign, he gathered all these different Christian sects, and he said, "Tell me what you believe." And, of course, he sided with the Roman church. And he passed a law in 380 A.D., forcing everyone to become Roman Catholic. And I'm going to read you a copy of the decree. Here's what it says. "To the residents of Constantinople, it is our will that all the peoples whom the government of our clemency rules shall follow that religion which a pious belief from Peter to the present declares the holy Peter," some of this is in legalese, guys, okay, so I'm doing my best with it, "delivered to the Romans, in which it is evident the Pontiff Damascus and Peter, Bishop of Alexandria, a man of apostolic sanctity, follow." Before I read further, I want to point out something about this decree. I want you to notice he calls Pontiff Damascus. Do you guys see that? Pontiff Damascus? Damascus was the Pope of this time. And Theodosius divested himself of the title Pontifex Maximus and gave it to the Pope in this year. So now what he's done is he's declared that all the Roman religion now is controlled by the Bishop of Rome, who we call the Pope. This is powerful information here. "That is, that according to the apostolic discipline and evangelical doctrine, we believe in the deity of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit of equal majesty and a holy Trinity." Once again, Theodosius is trying to impose Trinitarian belief on people in the empire. "Those who follow this law, we command, shall be comprised under the name of Catholic Christians. But others, indeed, we require as insane and raving." So we're insane and raving. No, we would have been considered at that time not in the Roman Catholic view, obviously, to bear the infamy of heretical teaching. Their gatherings shall not receive the name of churches. They are to be smitten first with the divine punishment and after that by the vengeance of our indignation, which has divine approval. So if you met in a church and you didn't believe in the Trinity and you didn't follow the religious practices of the Roman church, you were called insane, a heretic, and they didn't even call your building a church. Let me give you some more of his laws, and we're going to go through Theodosius. We're not going to cover every detail here in Theodosius, but we do have some very interesting details. So in 381, Theodosius does the opposite of Valens and Constantius. The pendulum swings the other way. All churches in the Eastern Empire were given to those who believed in the Trinity. In 386 AD, anyone who disturbed the peace of the Roman church was to be put to death. In 388, people were not allowed to debate religious matters in public. This guy created a very politically correct culture in the Eastern Roman Empire. I mean, just imagine not even being able to go out in public and talk about Jesus. In 392, those who disturbed the Roman Catholic faith were exiled. While pure paganism was gradually removed during his reign, especially in the Eastern Empire, it was replaced with a system that was part Christian and part pagan. Now, here's the thing. Let's get back to the subject matter of the Sabbath, okay? There were no Sunday laws, as I said, passed in the reigns of Constantius and Valens. But watch this. In 386, Theodosius supported the first Sunday law in history that tried to attach any reference to Jesus Christ. 386. And he passed two more in 389 and 392. Now the 392, and I do kind of got to tell you about this one. This one's kind of funny. So basically Theodosius says, okay, all the markets and all the entertainment, all has to be shut down on Sunday. Then 392, he said, except when Sunday falls on my birthday. All right. So, you know, where were his priorities at? You know, anyways, that's just... In fact, there were seven Sunday laws passed over about an 83-year period. And I have the years in which these laws were passed. 386, 389, 392, 399, 409, 425, 469. But there is no law against the Sabbath. In fact, there's actually an interesting law that protects some people keeping the Sabbath in the 400s. It's a pretty interesting law. Don't have time to get into that today, though. So now we're getting towards the conclusion here. So, let's look at Constantine's long-term influence. Now that we've reviewed the history, we can draw correct conclusions. Many Christians were socialized in a society where they rested on the Sabbath to honor God, but then they rested on Sunday because it was a civil day of rest. And eventually, some Christians observed both days. And we'll look at this in just a moment. I'm obviously not saying that's a positive thing, but I'm just saying this is what happened. Constantine's Sunday law laid the foundation for Roman Catholic Church to come in when it was interwoven with the Roman Empire and try to impose Christian meaning on an existing Sunday law, which was just a civil day of rest. Civil authority was used to try and ban people who disagreed with the Roman Catholic view. And again, this began at Nicaea, and over time, this had an indirect influence on the Sabbath. So what about Sabbath keeping? All right. My final slides here, which I have several quotes from people who lived in the 300s and the 400s AD. And they tell us about Sabbath keeping in this time period. Here's what Pseudo-Athanasius, this is a work some people believe to be ascribed to a man named Athanasius, some people do not agree with, so that's why I call it Pseudo-Athanasius. But it was accepted as legitimate at the time period. They met on the Sabbath, not that they were infected with Judaism, but to worship Jesus, Lord of the Sabbath. Now, Epiphanius, who wrote in the 360s AD, said that the apostles set services for the fourth day of the week, the Sabbath, Friday night, and on Sunday. But he gives, you know, when you read this in Latin, he gives no reasoning as to why or how he came to the conclusion the apostles ever wanted us to have services on Sunday. He never justifies that. This is another document called the Apostolic Constitutions. And here's what it says. It was written in this time period. But keep the Sabbath and the Lord's Day festival, because the former is the memorial of the creation and the latter of the resurrection. So what we can see in this time period is that there were Christians trying to do both days, even though that's not what God originally intended. But because of Constantine's civil Sunday law, people began to get socialized just to rest. Everything is shut down. So everything is shut down and people just kind of keep, you know, they have church on Sabbath and then they just keep meeting, show up, you know, after sunset on Saturday or on Sunday sometime. And it sort of just bleeds over into the first day of the week. But the Catholic Church still hated Sabbath. I mean, here's one of their guys, John Chrysostom. Oh, man. This guy hated anything that appeared out of the Old Testament. He says this, "There are many among us now who fast on the same day as the Jews and keep the Sabbaths in the same manner. And why do I speak of Jews, seeing that many Gentile customs are observed by some among us?" Now, this is pretty interesting because, number one, he complains about how many people are keeping the Sabbath, but then he also complains about how Gentile customs are still being observed by some in the church as well. Because again, in the time of Constantine and Theodosius, we see sort of a melding among some in the church of paganism and the Bible. We call that syncretism. Here's what Sozomen says. He says, "Likewise, some meet both upon the Sabbath and the day after the Sabbath, as at Constantinople, and among almost all others. At Rome and Alexandria, they do not." Socrates, who was another, this quote is very important. He says, "For although almost all churches throughout the world celebrate the sacred mysteries on the Sabbath of every week, yet the Christians of Alexandria and at Rome, on account of some ancient tradition, have ceased to do this." This quote is very important, because I want you to notice what he says about Rome and Alexandria. They were the only two cities in which the Sabbath was not observed in the 400s AD. So listen, what am I trying to tell you by giving you these quotes? Number one, when people try to tell you that the early apostles tried to change the Sabbath and everybody started keeping Sunday in the first or second century, these quotes, this is your weapon, this is your sword to say, no, that is not accurate. Most Christians kept the Sabbath into the 400s AD. Sunday was the later addition. And listen, Socrates even says, if you go back for just a moment to the Socrates quote, that Rome and Alexandria ceased to keep the Sabbath not because of the Bible, but because of a tradition. Now, I seem to remember Jesus telling us to avoid the traditions of men that contradict what? The commandments of God. And see, the Roman church, and if you read the writings, they always say, well, it's just our tradition. So here's the conclusion. The Sabbath was honored by most Christians in the 400s AD. At Rome and Alexandria, they stopped due to tradition. But unfortunately, a significant number of Christians at this time met on Sunday as well as Sabbath due to some of the actions of Constantine, which had a long-term effect. And eventually, the Sabbath was abandoned by most Christians, but there were a remnant of Sabbath keepers that remained long term. And then for my final thought, I want you to consider the two trees. You see, Constantine didn't ban the Sabbath. In some ways, that would have been an acknowledgement of when the Sabbath is by him, right? But instead, he did something really worse long term. He set up an imitation day of rest beside the real day of rest. And think about the two trees in the garden. The tree of life, which would correspond to the Sabbath. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which would correspond to Sunday. Think about NASA. I do want to say this too. Think about NASA. If they are off by 1 centimeter or 1 millimeter in some of their calculations, man, a satellite will be so far off course. Constantine added one imitation day of rest. Then hundreds of years later, Christianity as a whole was in a completely different place. So this is the conclusion of part 2 on Sabbath history. Thank you.